Chocolate, it's one thing you can always rely on, and it's always there for you. In her book, Chocolate, The Consuming Passion, cartoonist, author, and Grammy-nominated songwriter Sandra Boynton wrote about her favorite dessert at length, its history, its many forms, and why it's so universally loved. It was a bestseller when it was published in 1982, and now it is being reissued by Workman Press. And I'm very pleased to welcome Sandra Boynton to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Was there any other book like it at the time, 1982?
There really wasn't. Even Chocolate Obsession was an unknown thing. I thought it was exclusive to me until I'd done a greeting card about chocolate and realized it wasn't exclusive to me.
And then here you wrote this book, which is for adults about chocolate, but it's filled with cartoon hippos and pigs stuffing their faces.
Absolutely.
Why did you feel the need to update it after 30 years? How much of the book have you revised, and how much have there been changes in the chocolate world over the last three decades?
Oh, they're enormous changes, and I was somewhat unaware of them. The book stayed in print for a long time. It was in print till the late 90s, and the publisher kept asking me to update it, and I said, but I've already done the book, and you know, I'm doing other things. A couple years ago, someone gave me the best bar of chocolate I've ever tasted in my life, something nothing like I'd had before, and I said, okay, it's time to redo this book. I need to find out what's going on in the world of chocolate.
Well, why wasn't chocolate great from the start?
It actually has a lot to do with where the beans are grown and sourced, and in a sense, the passion of the chocolate makers. So the kind of chocolate I tasted a couple years ago was almost not even possible 30-something years ago. And then you get these craft fanatics really starting, they say bean to bar, but they're really starting from the ground up and working with farmers and doing amazing, amazing things.
So the artisanal movement has really gotten people excited about making small batches of chocolate?
Absolutely. Micro batches in some cases.
This is like craft beer.
It is. It's very much the same kind of insane passion and enterprise.
Well, you mentioned the best beans. The ancient Mesoamericans grew chocolate. That's where it started. But Mexico doesn't seem to be the primary source for the best chocolate. Why
well,
is that?
South America still is. You know, there's African chocolate, but the most extraordinary beans, I think, are coming from South America. Oddly enough, I've tasted some remarkable chocolate from Hawaii, of all places.
Well, they make coffee. Maybe wherever they grow coffee,
yes,
you grow chocolate?
Well, you're exactly right. It's 15 degrees of the equator, so, you know, north or south, so that's the chocolate growing band.
The ancient Mesoamericans consumed chocolate as a drink. They didn't make chocolate bars, and they didn't have sugar, so it must have been very bitter.
I think so. I think they also considered it an aphrodisiac, so there was a certain other... I think it actually really is an aphrodisiac. But,
you do?
I do, yeah. Well,
it is tied to romance.
It is, but there also are so many psychoactive properties in chocolate that it's not just the lure of it. It's there are actually physiological processes in it.
And it also can be seen as an equivalent to coffee because it contains some caffeine?
It does. It has actually three different stimulants in it, coffee being one of them.
So
caffeine being one of them, sorry.
When did someone come up with the idea of making a solid edible version of chocolate?
I think it's the 19th century, and I think it was eating chocolate was made by Fry in England in maybe the early 19th century.
It's interesting that England has had a long history of making chocolate, and Cadbury's is a huge company, and yet we don't think of English chocolate when we think of great chocolate.
Well, that's true, but I do think we're very indebted to England for the evolution of chocolate and the sort of eating direction.
But in the end, it wound up being France, Belgium, Switzerland.
Well, interestingly enough, yes, and now it's the U.S. that is the center of the craft chocolate movement. So this country has now become the epicenter. The International Chocolate Awards were just 2 days ago, and a lot of American companies were high up, including the best in show was this was the American company whose chocolate I had tasted and said, I need to redo this book.
What's the name of it? So
it's called Rogue Chocolateer, tiny micro batch.
R-O-B-E?
Rogue, like Rogue Nation, but Rogue Chocolateer. It's in Three Rivers, Massachusetts. Young man named Colin Gasco, I think he's all of 30 years old now, and he's a one-man show doing it truly from the ground up.
But even here in New York, one of the leading chocolatiers is French, yes. Jacques Torres, but he came here to make chocolate.
Right. No, I think that the consumers in this country have a particular insane passion for chocolate.
Well, for a long time, chocolate was just milk chocolate.
That's true.
What's happened? Yeah. There were three kinds of chocolate, dark, milk, and white.
Right. Well, it's moving much more towards dark chocolate, I think, as also I think the quality, huge difference between when I did the book the first time. This is actually not a sort of, they're not reissuing the book. I redid the whole thing. I re-researched it. I rewrote it.
Did you redraw it?
I redrew the whole thing, every single drawing. There
are
over 200 drawings in it. So it was really interesting to encounter my 28-year-old self when I was writing this book.
Were you embarrassed by some of your drawings from the past?
Interestingly enough, no. I didn't feel very connected in a way because it's so long ago. So as I was redrawing them, I would go, oh, I wonder why she drew the line this way. That's interesting.
You said she.
Yeah, well, really, I was sort of in a Caesar relationship to myself.
My guest is Sandra Boynton, whose book, Chocolate, The Consuming Passion, is now available in a completely new version from Workman Press, although in some ways it bears similarities.
Oh, it
does.
We
still
have
the hippos and the other animals.
It's structured in much the same way it will be familiar to.
And how did people react when they saw this book addressed to adults with all of these drawings that are more likely to turn up in your children's books?
Well, it's interesting. The book has just been published now. When it first came out, I wasn't known for children's books. I was known for greeting cards. So
that's where you got your start.
That's where I got my start. So the context was very different. So it's going to be interesting to see whether people think I've now taken my characters and put them in an adult book when really the evolution was in the other direction.
You come out very strongly for dark chocolate. What's wrong with milk chocolate, other than the fact that it tastes bland to me?
Well, the bland taste is a big part of the downside of milk chocolate. I think as with anything, the more you eat it, your taste becomes, I tend to like things a little bit more intense.
Although when you get 90% dark chocolate bars, they can be a bit bitter.
It depends who's making them. I mean, the bar that turned me around is 80%, you know, from Rogue. It's a Porcelana, a very rare bar. And it wasn't bitter at all, which astonished me. There are only two ingredients in it. He's got, you know, sugar, and he's got the dark chocolate, and it's amazing.
I can't imagine that it's being sold at my local Met Foods.
No, the quantities in which he's making it makes it pretty hard for you actually have to get on his waiting list sometimes.
Now, a lot of people will argue that white chocolate isn't really chocolate.
It is. It doesn't have the cocoa solids. It has cocoa butter, and it has vanilla, and it has sugar. So it has everything. It really is effectively chocolate, but without the thing that gives chocolate its chocolate taste. So no, it's not really chocolate.
And at one point you say, white chocolate has a great appeal for those who find that color and flavor interfere with the experience of texture.
Yes, yes, a little tongue-in-cheek.
How much chocolate will one cacao tree produce?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I really don't know that answer. I don't know the answer.
But people roast them the same way that they buy the beans.
Right.
And then they roast them the same way that they would roast coffee beans?
Yes, it's a similar process. The ferment.
But they don't have Oompa Loompas to help them?
I don't know, actually. So it is a similar process. The fermenting matters a lot of the beans.
You say that there's a set of criteria by which chocolate is evaluated, but it ends up being rather subjective. So would I almost certainly have loved that same Rogue chocolate that you loved?
It depends how much chocolate you eat, but I believe so. It was absolutely eye-opening. I truly still never tasted anything quite like it.
There's a nice little section in this book where you tell the reader how to ask for chocolate in 10 languages. Is there any place where chocolate is not considered a dessert?
Well, it's less, it seems to be, although this is changing, it seems to be less popular in Asian countries. I don't know why culturally, although that's changing. But I even do include how to ask for it in Klingon, because you never know where you're going to be traveling to.
Well, as I understand it, when the Columbian Exchange occurred and chocolate came to Europe, different people found different ways to serve it. And in Sicily, it was put used as often as an ingredient in a sauce for turkey, which was also new to the region, or chicken.
Well, certainly it's also known in like Mexican cooking, and mole is chocolate-based.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of them is, anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, the chocolate can go many, many places in many forms.
Now, there's a lot of funny stuff in this book, and I wasn't always sure whether all of those facts were really facts.
Do you have an example?
You have a side note about a chocolatier named Daniel Peter who tried to put cheese in his chocolate.
Daniel Peter is real, but the notoriously unsuccessful experiments are not.
Uh-huh.
But he's a real person.
Now, you've published something like 60-something books so far, most of them for kids, but not all of them.
Yeah, it's 65, I think, at this point.
And then you've also recorded 5 albums of children's music, Rhinoceros Tap, Philadelphia Chickens, which was nominated for a Grammy in 2002, Dog Train, Blue Moo, Frog Trouble. What motivated you to move towards making music? Couldn't you get enough of those animals in your books?
What motivated me is I have 4 children, and I don't like the music that's made for children in general. I find it a little deadening and condescending, and I've always been interested in music and done a lot of music, and when my youngest was 6, I said, okay, it's time. I really very much want to do the music, and it's really right now what I love most doing. I love writing and producing music.
Well, you do enlist some pretty impressive names for some of these tracks: Brian Wilson, Weird Al Yankovic, Meryl Streep, Patti LuPone. You just call them up and say, "How'd you like to be in a record about?"
I mostly do.
Animals?
They really aren't. They're really real music. If you were listening to my children's music in the next room, you wouldn't know you're listening to children's music. So it's legitimate music, and I've worked with, I worked with B.B. King, I worked with Brad Paisley, I work with people, I've worked with Ben Folds. I love working directly with these people. They all encounter music differently, and it's really what I love to do best.
Now, do you draw the animals differently when you're drawing for kids or for adults?
No. I don't really make much of a distinction between things for children and for adults anyway. I think that certainly the things I admire for children are for everyone. I sometimes call it the Rocky and Bullwinkle effect. I loved Rocky and Bullwinkle as a 5-year-old, and I love it now. It works on so many different levels.
You do like animals that have bulbous noses, so there must be some favorites.
I don't know.
Hippos?
I do. I like hippos. I like, I don't know. I like the essence of different animals. I like to draw chickens. I love to draw pigs. They're obviously pretty anthropomorphic. They're hardly zoologically accurate. It's just fun. I love cartooning.
There are alternatives that are offered to chocolate, carob, for example. Do they even come close to comparing?
No.
Why do some people insist on doing them? Do they claim that they're allergic to chocolate?
There are people who are allergic to chocolate, but more I think it's a misguided idea that there are healthy alternatives. Chocolate is very healthy. The sugar in it's not healthy, but chocolate, I think, and especially this comes out of my newer research on it, I think it is the superfood of all foods. It's just has remarkable both physiological and psychoactive properties.
Vegans can eat chocolate.
Yes, they can't eat milk chocolate, but they can eat chocolate.
chocolate is for everybody.
Of course.
Sandra Boynton's books have sold more than 60 million copies worldwide. She claims mostly to friends and family. Wow, what a family.
I know, it's a big family.
She's also written and produced live albums of award-winning children's music, and three of her albums have been certified gold. Philadelphia Chickens was nominated for a Grammy, and that one won platinum.
It did. It went platinum this year.
Uh-huh. Well, are you concerned now that people are just downloading them instead of buying them in the record stores?
Well, I guess everyone in music is concerned about that, but I don't know. I just love making the music.
The new version of Sandra Boynton's New York Times bestseller, Chocolate, The Consuming Passion, written, illustrated, and as it says here, over-researched by Sandra Boynton, is published by Workman Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much.